Well, church, we're going to be in Luke chapter 22 this morning. I'd invite you to join me there if you have a copy of God's Word in print or digital form. Very few of us have ever participated in any sort of military battle. But can you imagine the sense of anticipation as those first soldiers reached the beaches of Normandy there on D-Day, June 6, 1944? Imagine the variety of feelings that welled up in them. Certainly fear in the murky pre-dawn hours. What lay ahead of them? Undoubtedly knowing that many of them would not return. Certainly a sense of excitement. Been training and planning, and now finally the moment had come. The moment for action. There was undoubtedly a rush of adrenaline. I can't help but think that there was also a sense of heaviness. These soldiers knew what was at stake. Hitler's armies had swept across Europe, and Hitler was bent on world conquest. And the war was reaching a tipping point where it could have easily gone in favor of Hitler's Hitler's Germany, and these soldiers stood in the gap to repel Hitler's aggression. In our passage this morning here in Luke 22, Jesus was warning his disciples of an impending attack. A battle was on the horizon, and he was preparing his disciples, warning them for what was to come. I would suggest to you that in the same passage, Jesus is also warning us by extension as his followers down through the ages. If you haven't figured it out yet, the Christian life is not for sissies, right? We are engaged in a conflict, not with bullets and spears, swords, but a conflict in the spiritual realm for the hearts and souls of men and women. And this conflict certainly runs through every aspect of our lives. And it's here that Jesus prepares his disciples for this conflict. I want to begin with just the first two verses here in Luke 22. Simon, Simon, Luke 22, verse 31. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. After that Last Supper, Jesus and his disciples left the city and went to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives. The fateful moment was at hand. It was here that Jesus would be arrested, and he knew it. This was the crucible, the moment of testing. Now, obviously, Jesus is the central figure here. He had set his face towards Jerusalem, according to Luke 9:51. He made a relentless and determined journey to the cross. We witness his agony, particularly in this scene. He did not want to drink from the horrible cup of suffering, but he ultimately submitted himself to the Father's will. So Jesus is the central figure, but it would also signal the beginning of a spiritual battle for the disciples. They, too, are entering into the crucible. The text actually moves back and forth between Jesus and the disciples. Luke goes out of his way to sort of weave these accounts together so that we keep them both in view. And Jesus, even in the midst of his own unthinkable agony, is continuing to teach them and instruct them and model for them what it is to walk through this season of suffering. The disciples were clearly going to struggle. This would not be their finest moment, but these experiences would be formative. They would be invaluable as they would be called on to carry out this significant mission in the world. What do we glean here from this scene of testing that is outlined in these opening verses? I want to just highlight a couple of things here. First is that Maybe. I don't know if we're going to get this. We might need to advance that cue. All right, we'll get that tracking here. But Satan's testing is violent. So the first thing I want us to notice here is that Satan's testing is violent. Sifting is the word here. Sifting is the process of separating the wheat from the surrounding chaff. Separating the seed from the shell. And in the ancient world, they would oftentimes put the sheaves of grain out onto a flat rock, and they would beat it with sticks to try to break loose the seed from the shell. Or they would take a donkey and drag a heavy block of wood behind the donkey to just crush those kernels. Of course, in our time, the sheaves of grain are fed into harvesters, mechanized harvesters, and churned through metal tines. Satan is saying here, essentially, I don't believe Peter will remain faithful to Jesus if put to the test. Right? I want to crush him and find out what he's really made of. Right? The point here in all of this is that this is a vigorous and violent process. Satan means business, right? We also see here that Satan's testing is controlled. This is actually an encouraging aspect of the text here. Notice that Satan could not sift Peter without permission, right? You might remember that Satan approached God and made similar accusations about Job. Job only loves you because you have blessed him, God. His faith is not real. Take those blessings away and he will curse you. As Satan kept escalating his attacks against Job. But each time he had to ask permission. And the same is true here for Peter. Satan can only test within the parameters that God has established. Satan had to ask. And notice Jesus' awareness and monitoring of the situation, right? He was interceding for Peter that his faith would not fail. Peter was not alone. No matter how intense the struggle, he would not be abandoned. What a great encouragement for us as we think about our own testings and struggles in this context of spiritual warfare, that God is sovereign even over our trials. Satan's testing is controlled. Satan's testing is also widespread. Obviously, Jesus is talking to Peter here, right? Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded to sift you. But Peter is not the only one in view. When it says, Satan demanded to have you, that you is a plural you. In the South, they would say, Satan has demanded to have y'all, right? So Peter, Jesus is talking to Peter, but he's talking about all of the disciples. They were all going to experience Satan's sifting. Matter of fact, if you look just a little bit further here in verse 32, it says, when you have turned again, Peter, strengthen your brothers. Why would Peter have to strengthen the other disciples? It's because they were going to go through the same severe testing. Satan had already broken Judas. Right? He was now going to come after Peter. He would then turn his attention to the other disciples. And I have news for you, friends. Satan is coming for you. Satan is coming for you. Satan is the adversary of Jesus and all those who follow Jesus. Look at Revelation chapter 12 and verse 17. It unpacks this. Satan is opposed to all of Jesus' followers. If Satan is not your adversary, it is because you are not a follower of Jesus. So we see this widespread aspect of Satan's testing that is hinted at even here in these opening verses. Well, the conflict unfolds in four distinct stages, and I'm calling this the intentional response. So we have the impending attack that is spoken of here at the outset. And then we have the intentional response. We get a sense of how the disciples were to respond in the midst of Satan's attacks. Each of these scenes and stages includes a separate imperative command. Again, they're given to Peter and to the 12 disciples in very specific circumstances, but they are clearly transferable. How do you respond when tested? How do you respond when your faith is sifted and shaken violently? How do you prepare for the devious and persistent attacks of the enemy? Here's my thesis this morning. A determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy. A determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy. Satan is real. He's active in the spiritual realm. He is opposed to God's people. And that means we don't live in fear. We don't act as though we're defeated. But we do respond very carefully, very decisively to his strategies. So four things that emerge here from Jesus' instructions to the disciples. Number one, band together. Band together. Let's pick up here in verse 32. Jesus says, "But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." Peter said to him, "Lord, I am ready to go with you both into prison and to death." Jesus said, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you know me." Band together. Commit yourself to other believers. You notice what Jesus says here? When you emerge from the other side of this struggle, Peter, strengthen your brothers. You see, Peter would be the first to be shaken and tested, but he would not be the last. When he came out on the other side, he would be uniquely qualified to help the other disciples navigate their own struggles. You see, Jesus intended for his followers to work together, to encourage each other. And he communicates something very profound here. His disciples were brothers. Do you notice the language here? Strengthen your brothers. Not your friend, not your acquaintance, not your fellow fisherman, not your business partner, your brothers. Jesus causes Peter to think about these other disciples through this unique lens. They were family. And they had a responsibility to one another, and they needed each other. Jesus' followers would encounter something of such intensity that they would not be able to navigate it on their own. ESPN has been airing a docuseries on the 1997-98 Chicago Bulls season. They had already won five championships and were going for their sixth championship. Michael Jordan was the unquestioned leader of that team, and he was supremely confident, we might even say arrogant, about his own abilities. But the fact is that he doesn't win anything without Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman, the rest of his teammates, and a really gifted coach, Phil Jackson, who was able to navigate all of those really big personalities, right? If all those other pieces aren't there, Jordan doesn't win one championship by himself. The mission that we are engaged in is, of course, much greater consequence, much greater complexity than an NBA championship. It is of such a scope that it will not be accomplished alone or by a number of people operating alone. Christian life is not a solo pursuit. It is a collective endeavor. And you and I should commit ourselves to other believers for our own sake, right? In other words, I need other people to speak truth into my life. I need other people to kick me sometimes. I need other people to put their arm around me sometimes. I need to glean from other people's insights who are further along in the journey than I am. But we also should commit ourselves to our brothers and sisters for their sake, right? Other people need what I have to offer. Other people need to be pushed and encouraged by us. This involves, you know, baptism and church membership and engagement in a small group where you can know and be known, where you can be encouraged and confronted. A determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy, and it must be a corporate strategy. As they head into war, Jesus sets the stage here for what's going to be involved. They're going to have to band together. Powerful lesson for us in an individualistic society and culture where people largely view their faith as a private endeavor. The church is great if to the degree that it's helpful, or it seems to kind of affirm them. But sometimes the church gets in the way. The church is difficult. Boy, we need to think corporately. The fact that the church is difficult is part of the point. The friction is what I need to push me further, to help me love better. And so we need to band together. The second element here to the strategy, and that is the word brace for conflict. Brace yourself for conflict. Notice verse 35 as the scene progresses. He said to them, "When I sent you out with no money bag or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "Nothing." He said to them, "But now, let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack, and let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me, 'And he was numbered with the transgressors.' For what is written about me has its fulfillment." And they said, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough." Brace yourself for conflict. Understand what's coming. Jesus made it clear that to these first disciples that they were facing a new reality, right? A battle was looming. Up until this point, they had lived in relative ease. Even though Jesus had sent them out without any money, their needs had been provided for, and they experienced general peace and success in their missionary endeavors. But all that was about to change. They would now face war and the hardship that goes along with it. And so Jesus urged them to make adequate preparations, right? Gather your money, pack your bags, obtain a sword. And notice the reason for the shift here in the text. Jesus was going to be numbered among the transgressors. He was going to be condemned as a criminal. The nation was going to turn against him. And it would also turn against them. They would soon be outlaws, without a country, at odds with mainstream culture. Now, what did Jesus mean by these instructions about money bag and backpack and sword? Did he literally want them to buy swords so that they could fight? This is a major point of conversation in this text, and the context, I believe, is going to make it very clear what Jesus intended. But I think even here, we get a little glimpse of it in the nature of Jesus' dialogue with the disciples, right? So he tells them essentially to all buy swords, and the disciples kind of look around and say, "Well, we have two here, Jesus. Is this enough?" And Jesus says, "It is enough." Two swords would certainly not be enough if they were going to wage literal war, but they weren't going to wage a literal war. Jesus was speaking here metaphorically. Be prepared for the conflict that lies ahead. Ernest Shackleton, great explorer, would lead an exploration of the South Pole on his ship, the Endurance. Eventually, that ship would become packed in ice, forcing the crew to disembark and make their way on foot, pulling along some of the small lifeboat vessels. It was a harrowing journey. Reportedly, Shackleton took out an advertisement. He said, men wanted for hazardous journey, low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in event of success. There are actually many questions about whether Shackleton ever actually posted that article in the newspaper. But Jesus did. He told his disciples in no uncertain terms what was ahead of them, the difficulties that they would face. He wanted them to have their eyes opened. Understand what you're signing up for. Don't be caught off guard. Don't be disillusioned when you face difficulty. It is part of the package. Adjust your expectations. God never promised us a safe life. He never promised us smooth sailing. As a matter of fact, when a person turns and becomes a follower of Jesus, their life gets harder. Now, we know that there is joy in this mission. There's a sense of fulfillment and purpose. We're involved in something of eternal significance. And the expedition will end in success. It is assured. But you are making a decision to paddle upstream. You're charting a course that is against the winds of the prevailing culture. We happen to be coming out of a time in our country which, our country largely embraced a Judeo-Christian ethic. But that's changing. And the fact is that that's not the norm. See, a determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy. And it must be an unflinching strategy, right? We must be given to determination, knowing that it will be a difficult journey. Brace yourself. Brace yourself for the conflict that will come. There's a third imperative here, a third scene that is unfolded, in which Jesus tells them to find your strength in God. Find your strength in God. Verse 39. And he came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, why are you sleeping? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation. Find your strength in God. Bring your unbearable burdens to him. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, as was his custom, and the disciples followed him. We're clearly meant to see the comparison between Jesus and his disciples. Jesus was out in front. He was modeling for them, not just leading them into the garden, but even leading them in the midst of the garden, showing them what it was to pray, to pour out their burdens to God, to find strength outside of themselves. Jesus had come to the garden that evening weighed down by burdens. He urged the disciples to pray so that they would not give in to temptation. Jesus was showing them what to do when they were overwhelmed. Quite simply, Jesus was being tempted to defect. He was being tempted to turn away from this path of suffering and take the easy way out, to give up. By the way, this was the same temptation that Jesus faced in the wilderness at the outset of his ministry. Right? Satan is trying to urge him to not go through with this. Temptation was severe. Jesus dropped to his knees. Most customary in this culture to pray standing, but we have this scene of tremendous pressure where Jesus is brought to his knees and his sweat was like drops of blood. There are some medical phenomena where under extreme stress, blood vessels actually burst. And we don't know if that's what's happening here, if the language is metaphorical, but in any regard, Jesus was under the press. Matter of fact, the Garden of Gethsemane is literally the garden of the press, the garden of the olive press. And they would put the grapes in this trough and roll this heavy stone around and crush the grapes. And Jesus here in the garden is being crushed under the weight of God's wrath, right? He has taken the sins of the world upon himself. And he's feeling that weight. And the disciples, too, would be tempted to walk away. Luke actually tells us here that they were sleeping. But not just that they were sleeping for sorrow. This is a really interesting phrase. They were not simply tired. They were overcome with grief. They were emotionally depleted. There was a sense of foreboding. Jesus had told them again that he was going to die. There's just a heaviness about them. And maybe some element of discouragement and despair. They too were in danger of losing heart. And so Jesus urges them to follow his example and pray. Jonathan Gibson recently wrote a wonderful little book called The Moon is Always Round. The Moon is Always Round. I would commend it to you if you get a chance to read it. Have a tissue handy. It's a little bit sad, but a great reminder about God's character. So the little boy is noticing that the moon often looks different, right? Sometimes it's a crescent, sometimes it's a half moon, sometimes it's a full moon, and he's commenting on this to his dad. The moon is always changing. And the father wisely keeps telling his son that the moon is always round. The moon is always round, even when you can't see it. And it was the father's way of teaching his son about the unchanging faithfulness of God. When the whole world seems upside down and it feels as if God has abandoned us, we need to remind ourselves that the moon is always round. That God is always faithful, even when it doesn't seem like it to our eyes. See, a determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy, and it must be a faith-filled strategy. A strategy that is not simply oriented around what can be seen in our present circumstances, but a strategy that looks beyond that to what is true and what is real. Find your strength in God. In the midst of battle, in the midst of the conflict, understand where your source of power lies. Finally, put away your sword. Here's the final instruction, the imperative command that is given to the disciples. Verse 47. While he was still speaking, there came a crowd, and the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? And when those who were around him saw what would follow, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus said, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders, who had come out against him, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. Put away your sword. Stop trying to fight spiritual battles with worldly weapons." Here's the moment of Jesus' arrest, and John tells us that Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and addressed Judas. Even here, it is clear that Jesus is in charge, right? No one would take Jesus' life, but he would offer it freely. He was not caught off guard there in the Garden of Gethsemane. He went into it with his eyes wide open. Now, it took a moment for the disciples to realize what was happening, that their friend, Judas, had betrayed them, and that this was a moment in which Jesus was going to be captured by the religious leaders. And when that became evident, the disciples stood up to defend Jesus. They asked him, is it now the time to use our swords, Jesus? And apparently they didn't wait for an answer. Instead, they started swinging, and one of them cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. Again, Jesus is the central figure here, right? He's being arrested. He's being taken away for trial, a trial that will ultimately end in his crucifixion. But notice again that Jesus is communicating something really important here to the disciples. You're not to fight with the weapons of this world. When I spoke about swords, I was speaking metaphorically. We are not seeking to conquer bodies, but hearts. Jesus responded to physical attack with the piercing words of truth. I had a small deck project going on this weekend, and in my haste, I bought 5-inch bolts. When in reality, I needed 8-inch bolts. And so I actually got down and I got the posts, and I hadn't accounted for the beams that I was attaching to the 4x4 post. And so I get the bolt actually into the hole before I realize I don't have long enough bolts, right? Now, I could get my hammer out and pound on those bolts, but they would never work. They were the wrong product, the wrong bolt for the job. And we can be guilty of using the wrong weapons. And doggedly so. Keep pounding that bolt when it's not going to work. It's not going to accomplish the purpose to which we've been called. Paul addressed this in 2 Corinthians 10. "For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds." Divine power to destroy strongholds in the spiritual realm, right? We're not wielding swords here. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ. Our work, our mission has to do with the hearts of men and women. Paul would write in Ephesians 6 that our weapon is the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And the disciples had to learn this lesson the hard way. We too are often tempted to fight with the world's weapons, with physical force, with hurtful words, with scheming, with political maneuvering, with manipulation, with misrepresentation, through silence, retribution, etc., etc., etc. But this is not God's battle plan. See, a determined enemy calls for a decisive strategy. And it must be a spiritual strategy, a strategy that addresses the heart. Well, there's a closing episode here in the text that I've called the gentle look. Ends where we began with Peter. The text says there that Peter denied. We know the account well. Peter denied Jesus three times. And it says there, a very critical moment, that Peter, that the Lord looked at Peter, that he looked at him. There was a telling glance in Peter's direction. And Peter went off and wept bitterly. I found myself thinking about that look. It's recorded in the various gospel accounts. That look, what was being communicated in that look? Not only did Peter deny Jesus, but Peter knew that Jesus knew that he had denied him. I would suggest that it was not a look of condemnation, but a look of interest, love, and concern. The look was certainly a reminder to Peter that Jesus had predicted his betrayal, right? That's why he went out and wept bitterly. But it was also a reminder of the other things Jesus had said, right? Jesus was praying for him. Jesus was praying that his faith would not fail. Jesus was acknowledging that there would be a time when Peter would turn again and strengthen his brothers. It was not a look of condemnation, but a look of love. Matter of fact, the same terminology is used in John chapter 1, verse 42. The first time Jesus met Peter, it says that he looked at him. This bumbling fisherman with a terrible temper, he looked at him and he called him to follow. And I believe that in this look, Jesus was reiterating his love and concern for Peter. Broke Peter's pride and made him a more effective and compassionate leader. He experienced grace and he was transformed. Jesus, again, has warned us about the nature of conflict, called us to the spiritual battle that lays before us, given us all that we need to prevail, laid out a strategy for those first disciples and for us. Peter's failure is a reminder that we will not always succeed, that we will not necessarily emerge unscathed, but we're reminded here of Jesus' never-ending love.